In 1995, Comet 73P did something very unexpected. It fell apart for no apparent reason. The comet's nucleus split into at least three mini-comets flying single-file through space. Astronomers watched with interest, but the view was blurry even through large telescopes. 73P was 150 million miles away. And we're about to get a much closer look in May of this year. The fragments are going to fly past Earth closer than any comet has come in more than 20 years. Now, they say there is no danger of a collision. The closest fragment will be about 6 million miles away, 25 times farther than the moon. But that's close. But they don't think it's very scary. And Europe's Venus Express probe has returned its first images since slipping into the orbit around our nearest planetary neighbor. You can see these pictures on coasttocoastam.com. Mission scientists are already intrigued by a dark vortex feature, which can be clearly seen in one image. The Venus Express will orbit the planet for about 500 Earth days to study its atmosphere, which is thought to have undergone runaway greenhouse warming. In a moment, we're going to run with William Henry. He's back from Egypt. He's going to tie it into Atlantis. All that on Coast to Coast AM. Well, he's an investigative mythologist. He is an author. His name is William Henry. He's a regular guest on Coast to Coast. He's been to Egypt. He's got a new DVD set called Egypt, The Shadow of Atlantis. And he links the Atlantis myth with Egypt. Some incredible pictures on the coasttocoastam.com website, by the way, that William and his group have supplied to us. Welcome, William Henry. Hello, William. How are you?
Hey, George. How are you? Great to talk with you.
You know, if we played sound effects, we would have a huge audience in the background applauding every time you would come on.
Oh, and that would be Jimmy Page over there in the corner playing guitar, too.
Absolutely. So I trust you had a safe trip to Egypt and back.
I did. Thank you. Safe and truly, truly wonderful. Absolutely transformative and just so excited to come back and report some of this new information, some really groundbreaking stuff that is just magic.
How long were you out there?
2 weeks.
Are you at all skittish when you're out there? I mean, there's been so much happening in the Middle East. I mean, sometimes I would think, my gosh, if I'm going to sit here in this cafe, is some lunatic going to walk in and blow himself up? I mean, do you think about things like that? Are you more aware of your surroundings?
Well, just a little bit. You're in a foreign country. You're in a land that is predominantly Muslim, and you just never know these days what may be coming around the next bend. But Egypt is such a place of just tremendous open-heartedness, and the people are amazingly friendly. They love Americans, and they have this viewpoint that is just unparalleled anywhere. The one thing I did notice that was different about my last trip, though, is that it seems that some of the market people were a little too aggressive. It's like they must be suffering a little bit economically somehow. But other than that, there was not a single moment where I could say I felt any kind of fear or any danger whatsoever.
Now, when you say aggressive, the market people are aggressive. Give me a for instance. You'd be what, like walking through the market? What would happen?
Well, yeah, I was one day I was walking with two of our guests, women, and one stayed behind to take a look at an item, and before she knew it, she had hands all over her, and they're begging her for money, and that's kind of the treatment. And of course, it was tremendously unnerving for her and felt just awful about what had happened, but it's just kind of the sign of the times there, I think.
Well, and if you give them money, it becomes a feeding frenzy, doesn't it?
It really does. They literally come out of nowhere. And one of the most difficult things to handle on an emotional level is when it's the children that are coming up asking for things. I mean, you have to just understand that this is the way of life that they're brought up in, and you hope that things are beginning to transform there, where they're going to have opportunities to expand their lives that aren't there presently. So it's heartbreaking in many, many times, but you have to just move through it and accept it.
I looked at some of the pictures of Egypt that you had emailed me, William, a few days ago, and I got to tell you, it looks in some cases as if that area has stayed the same for 2,000 years.
Yeah. When you go to some of these remote villages, George, you are stepping back in time and experiencing Egypt little changed for several to 5,000 years. The only difference that is, and it's so strange, is that you'll be out in a remote village. Let's say you're on a bus and you're driving to Abydos, one of my favorite places, and it's very rural, very country, out in the middle of nowhere. You see these mud brick homes sitting beside the canal with satellite dishes on top of them.
That's funny.
Yeah.
You wonder if they even have electricity, but they've got those satellite dishes.
I mean, it's like they skipped the past 2,000 years and are just going right into the 21st century and watching Wheel of Fortune or something. It's bizarre.
That is something. What was the purpose of going to Egypt this time?
Well, I had lots of follow-up research that I wanted to do. I also had along with me the National Geographic Channel.
Oh, really?
Yes. This was a surprise. Came up about a month before the trip. They had gotten in touch with a gentleman who was one of our guests on the trip, and they learned about some of the research that I was doing. They're doing a program on Atlantis, and they have grown somewhat weary of the typical Edgar Cayce Atlantis rising story.
Right.
And Atlantis is Thera, and the volcano at Thera, the whole
world. Well, that's all great stuff, William, but it's been said a million times.
Exactly. And so they kind of looked at me and said, well, this guy's got a little bit of a breath of fresh air. He's got a different take on it, a different perspective. And I had no idea before we left that they were going to spend as much time with me as they did. Literally 5-6 days, I had a camera in my face virtually at all times, everywhere I went. And unfortunately, everywhere the group went, too, the National Geographic channels were on us, and they tried to be as unobtrusive as possible, but some people got a little bit irritated about it, and I apologize for that. But overall, they were trying to really document an Egyptian experience, especially an Egyptian experience coming from someone who's there to investigate these mysteries.
All right, beyond Abydos, so what locations did you go to?
Well, we hit them all. We hit all the major sites, the Great Pyramid, of course, the Sphinx, learned a tremendous amount of new information there from another of our guests, Mr. Freddie Silva. And then we went on down to, of course, Abydos, Dendera, Luxor, Abu Simbel, Philae, all the major sites. We hit them. I mean, it was quite an excursion.
What is it like, William, to be really close, maybe even at the base of the foot of the Sphinx and the pyramids of Giza?
To me, when you first stand there, I had no doubt whatsoever that I was looking at a monument that was the product of an advanced civilization that probably even exceeds our capabilities today. It is the most awe-inspiring experience you can ever imagine in your life. Any photograph you ever see of the Great Pyramid only serves to diminish the personal experience that you have on that plateau.
Of course, you can't tell Zahi Hawass that you think it had some kind of extraterrestrial intervention. He'll go crazy.
Oh, totally nuts. And in fact, that is the tightrope that I sort of have to walk. It's this idea that before the first Egyptian dynasty around 3100 BC, that there was an advanced race that inhabited this area, whether or not they came from outside of Egypt or inside of Egypt. Today, you can't talk about that, and the reason is because of what the Nazis did with this master race theory, this super race theory. Before 1932, it was fairly widely accepted among Egyptologists that there was, at one time, this advanced race in Egypt. After Hitler, if you even consider that or contemplate that idea, it's not only politically incorrect, they label you a racist because they say, oh, now you're denying Egyptian heritage. That's not true at all. What we're trying to do is dig for the truth here. And unfortunately, politics and to a large extent religion have intervened once again to put the blinders on us. And it's a very, very frustrating experience.
Yeah, that is a shame. Was he around wherever you were, or did he not show up? Hawass.
Like a hawk. Everywhere we went, especially with National Geographic.
Oh, I mean, he loves those cameras.
Right. I mean, those two words, National Geographic, opened doors that are normally closed. But even they, to be quite honest with you, have to sort of tiptoe around on eggshells around him because you just never know how he's going to respond. And wait till he gets a hold of this program. He's going to have a, you know, his coffee, I'm sure, is going to be all over his television screen when he sees what I have to say.
He's got a lot of energy, but as you have just pointed out, and as we have witnessed just by seeing him in the past on some of these live events when they try to go down the shafts of some of the pyramids, he is a booster for Egypt and will not back down on it to the point where I got to believe the guy, William, has a pretty big temper.
Yes. Yeah, I would concur with that. And that's why I just prefer, hey, you know, would love to meet him sometime. I mean, just out of respect, because he is the in charge of the Antiquities Council in Egypt. I mean, but at the same time, I am wise enough to know, hey, I got to aim high, pick my shots, and be passionate. And if he doesn't want to accept my shots, hey, that's okay. He's going to try and block them, or he's going to refute them, and that's just the way it is. But so long as he plays fair, and that's my only real concern in a lot of these areas, especially with academics and some researchers, they do not play fair. And it's largely to satisfy their own ego, I believe, but ultimately it's all of us that lose when people put their personal beliefs in front of what we think is a search for the truth.
You know, William, you know, you've been with me now for years. This is the most riled up I've ever heard you. Did he try to pull a fast one out there?
No, not at all. I guess you're just kind of pushing the right button tonight, George.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're back safe and sound.
Oh, me too. Believe me. The whole time I'm in Egypt, George, I'm thinking, well, okay, April 13th, I'm going to be home. I'm going to be talking with George. Everything's going to be okay. So thanks for being kind of a beacon for me and a little light at the end of the tunnel for me.
Oh, that's okay. Well, you were out there during the total solar eclipse, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. And how do people react? Because I have heard that in some countries that some people are panicked stricken over an eclipse.
Well, sure. I mean, it's one of the single most powerful experiences that you can have. We had actually planned to go into what is called the Path of Totality, which was running along the border between Egypt and Libya. Originally, the estimate was going to be they were anticipating around 5,000 people to descend on this tiny village of Saloum. By the time all of the eclipse tour people got involved, there were nearly 50,000 people descending on this tiny dot of real estate that was equipped for more like 500. And so what we decided to do is to go to a closed archaeological site, which we're going to talk about in detail tonight, I hope, called Abu Ghraib, which is about 15 minutes as the heron flies from the Great Pyramid. And we experienced the total eclipse of the sun there. And that was absolutely the best choice. We were all alone and had just a truly wonderful afternoon.
Well, you know, as you go out to Egypt to look at the pyramid, the Sphinx, and the other incredible structures that are out there, what happens to you as a human being, William, when you see this? I've never had the luxury of being in Egypt. I mean, does your psyche change? Do you start to think about, that this universe is different? What happens to you?
That's a phenomenal question, George, because that is exactly what happens. When you are there, you are, one, stepping back in time and experiencing temples in an experience that is thousands of years old. You're stepping into a vast movie set, if you will, and the name of the movie is Transform This Ordinary Mortal That Has Stepped On to This Great Land Called Egypt That Was Anciently Called Khem. Give us your heart. Give us your mind. We'll feed your soul. And that is what happens in Egypt. I made the mistake this time. It's no mistakes, but in my second presentation, I was talking about how important this concept of lightness of heart is to the ancient Egyptians. It was symbolized by a feather, and the idea was that at the time of death that your heart would be weighed against the feather, and if it was heavier, then they were going to press the recycle button on you, essentially. This experience for me was utterly transformative because I learned that I had a heavier heart than I really appreciated before in my life. Egypt took care of that through the people that were on the tour, the circumstances of the tour, being in Egypt itself. For me, this time was a cleansing and transformative experience that I know is setting my life into a new direction. And that is the potential that Egypt has for everybody that visits. And I hope, George, that I'll be able to go with you when you go your first time.
Well, I like the way you said that, when I go, because I do want to get out there one day. Do they have capabilities of doing broadcasts live out there, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, you can use your wireless computer system to make phone calls. They've got all kinds of any kind of modern technological implement that you would need is just a heartbeat away. So, absolutely.
That would be an interesting broadcast with Zahi Hawass jumping in every once in a while if I said the wrong thing. Censoring me. You talked about Abydos. Fascinates me primarily because of that, I guess, that template, that etching that shows what looks like a helicopter and a submarine. You know that picture I'm talking about?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, the temple guards there know all about it, too, the temple keepers, and they'll take you there for a small fee. It's one of the primary attractions there.
What do they say about that?
Well, they kind of go along with it. Some people have tried to refute that, saying that the glyph is actually caused by two overlapping hieroglyphs. But hey, I look at it, and it sure looks like a tank and a helicopter to me. And when you factor in the strangeness that surrounds Abydos and its location beside this temple called the Osirian, which many believe is actually at least 10,000 years old, it suggests to me that this could well be a representation of a technology that existed long, long ago that was immortalized on the walls at Abydos.
Do other Egyptians kind of share that too, or do they believe whatever Zahi Hawass is talking about?
Well, quietly. I mean, at first, your guides basically tell you the party line. And after about the first 30 seconds of that, the whole group is saying, well, now tell us what you really think.
Yeah.
And they start to open up just a little bit and share some of their own personal convictions. And that's when you really start to learn. I mean, as you can imagine, the folks that travel with me are not your average tourists. They know when someone is feeding them a line, and they're quite capable of refuting the talk or refuting the facts that the person is giving them and asking the penetrating questions that will reveal the actual truth of a situation. And so, I mean, that's what happened with the guide that we had on our tour, is that he finally gave up and started offering his own personal views based upon his research and started to even question some of the other things that he has been taught by traditional Egyptology.
And I bet he had a better time, too, didn't he?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we were quite a handful, but still, I think he's going to go back and look at these monuments the next time with a little bit clearer vision.
William, whenever you travel, you have a mission. I mean, you've been to Rennes-le-Château, and you've been to different areas around this planet, but you go out there with a focus, with a specific reason. Did you on this particular trip?
Well, I did. I was wanting to go to Abu Ghraib, especially this incredibly magical place that I had never been before, and investigate the possibility that it was an ancient stargate. That's what indigenous Egyptian tradition says, is that this was a place of connection where the divine beings called Neter may have, in the ancient past, quote-unquote, landed.
Let's talk about that when we come back, William. What a great staff. We're talking about Egypt with William Henry, and they've got the right bumper music already picked out. They're quick. Hey, if you're a fan of Dr. Doom, Ed Dames, or Glynis McCants, the numbers lady, Be sure to get your hands on the May issue of the After Dark newsletter. You'll also get 14 issues for the price of 12. Ed decides he's not going to hold back anymore, and he'll tell us what he really thinks of Luciferian Aaron Donahue and that issue, so make sure you read this one. Subscribe now by calling 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505. Operators are there now, or subscribe online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. I'm George Norrie, William Henry. William, let's talk about this Stargate mission you're on.
Great. Yeah, this place I went to, I investigated, is called Abu Ghraib. It's the same name as that despicable prison. Iraqi prison.
Oh, my business. God, yeah. You weren't there, were you?
No. But it's a place in Egypt, again, about 12, 15 miles from the Great Pyramid. In fact, when you're standing on the pyramid at Abu Ghraib, you can actually see the Great Pyramid Complex as well as Saqqara and the other areas. You're literally in what's called a pyramid field, which is what it sounds like, a field of pyramids that are ancient, ancient, ancient.
They look crumbling in the pictures you sent me. They're falling apart.
Exactly. In fact, this is it's with a little bit of concern about that I actually decided to talk about Abu Ghraib. I consulted with Stephen Mailer, author of The Land of Osiris, about this when I got home, who has also spoken about Abu Ghraib and said, Stephen, gosh, you know, I've got some tremendous new information about Abu Ghraib, but personally, I'm not sure I really want to call it that much attention to the place because it's so fragile. It's a closed to the public archaeological site. It's questionable about whether or not we actually broke the law going there. And it's not set up for spiritual warriors to all of a sudden start making a beeline for the place. But I decided that I think that this information is just too important to keep to myself, and have decided, okay, well, we've really got to talk about this place because it has so many ramifications in so many different areas concerning the study of the ancients, possibly concerning the Anunnaki, and also this idea of stargates.
Okay, so you go on out there, you're looking for this ancient stargate, and give me your definition of this stargate.
Well, the Stargate is both either a portal, a literal door or gate leading to the stars, or it's a location where star beings come through in the form of energies that the ancient Egyptians knew as netters, N-E-T-E-R-S. That's where we get our word nature. And according to Abdel Al-Kilkim, who is Stephen Mailer's teacher and others, this site was designed specifically to create heightened spiritual awareness through vibrations that were transmitted through this massive, massive alabaster crystal platform sitting in front of this pyramid there. In fact, ancient Egyptian legend, or Kemeshian legend to be more specific, says that these netters, these divine energies, or even divine beings actually landed at Abu Ghraib. And this is why it's considered to be not only the most ancient or oldest ceremonial center on the planet, but one of the most sacred places on the planet as well.
See, I don't know if the Giza pyramids are 5,000, 10,000, or even older years old. These looked pretty old. I mean, they looked like they were ready to fall apart.
Yeah, they do. And in fact, there's hallmarks that identify the age of this site and link it to others. And the primary hallmark is the use of these precision cut, polished, and placed red granite casing stones that you see on the front of the pyramid. And in fact, I believe I've got a plate that's on the Coast to Coast site that shows this red granite in front of this pyramid. Yeah, I believe it's plate number 3.
All right.
When we look at this, we're seeing these massive granite blocks that are, as I say, precision cut, polished in place with extraordinary accuracy by some group of beings that had some method of maneuvering and placing these stones that does not seem to be attributable to any normal means that we would see.
There's a guy with a chisel, William.
Yeah, right. I mean, take a copper chisel and see what a copper chisel looks like after a confrontation with a big slab of red granite like this.
What about the theory that the blocks were poured blocks in the spots that they are? So they built, you know, the frame, and then they poured, I would guess, what, liquid limestone or something, and it hardened?
Well, I think that that's a very interesting theory. I haven't personally seen enough evidence to say that that's the way they did it. Anti-gravity has also been suggested. One of my all-time goals now, I interviewed Stephen Mailer on Dreamland last year, and before I did so, it was kind of cool because a woman emailed me saying, well, you know, you two guys kind of disagree on some things, but I think that between the two of you, you are going to come up with irrefutable proof of ancient Egyptian anti-gravity. And ever since I've received that email, that's become sort of my life's quest. And I'm looking forward to furthering my connection with Stephen and Hakeem, his teacher, and others that are attempting to recover this ancient secret of anti-gravity. So anybody who has any insight into that, please let me know.
Well, he's dead, unfortunately. Edward Leeds Scullin, the
You're
guy
right.
who built the Coral Castle.
You're right.
Same
Absolutely
technology.
Right.
And I believe he was once quoted as saying he possessed the technology of the Egyptians.
Well, it's there. And the thing that drives me, George, is that we hear about this ancient indigenous oral tradition that exists in Egypt. And the way I came to understand that on this recent trip is that the stones there speak, the temples speak, the gods and goddesses speak to you. If you have the right energy, the right frequency, the open heart, the open mind, you can literally, quote unquote, be gifted with this knowledge. Some people today refer to it as a download. And I literally believe that this knowledge is in the vibrations of the stones in the temples themselves, and it's there for us to access if we approach this place with the right, quote-unquote, attitude.
Now, when you go and you're searching for information on a Stargate, are you looking for the Stargate specifically?
Well, I'm looking for depictions that portray gods aboard craft that resemble precisely the way modern science portrays wormholes.
All right.
For one thing, I'm looking for evidence of ancient particle accelerators, devices that are used to drill holes in space. And I have found evidence of that at Abydos. And I have found numerous examples over and over again portraying the gods sailing aboard their craft that resemble wormholes into gates that are composed of stars. I call those gates composed of stars stargates.
And the craft, based on what we have seen, people have witnessed, the oval shapes and cigar shapes, things like that?
No, actually, the craft that they're riding in look like the classic depiction of a wormhole, which has an open mouth on one end, it has a throat, and an open mouth on the other end. In fact, one of the plates that I supplied, plate number one, portrays one of these immortal beings with a light heart sailing into a net or a field that is called the Field of the Blessed. Ancient Egyptian myth, legend, and references suggest that this Field of the Blessed that this figure is sailing into is another dimension.
That is fascinating, William. I mean, can you imagine stumbling into this?
Well, I know. And so that's why I was so tremendously excited, because here is some references to this specific place, Abu Ghraib, as having been constructed long ago as one of these, what I call, stargates. And so here it is, and it's near what is today fragile, but still quite undisturbed state. I mean, this place looks the way it might have thousands and thousands of years ago. Now, what we need to add into this, too, as we continue our conversation, is that while there, we discovered that this site might even match what Zachariah Sitchin describes as one of the Anunnaki gold mining, gold processing sites, adds a whole nother dimension to this site as well.
Can you imagine if you were able to prove that? Oh, would you blow this wide open?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. And now, I have to offer this caveat again. Most of what I knew about Abu Ghraib going in came from Stephen Mailer and his teacher, Hakim. Now, neither Hakim nor Stephen Mailer support Sitchin's ideas of a metal-producing plant at Abu Ghraib, nor do they like the idea of Atlantis either. Hakim is adamant that ancient Kemet was not a colony of Atlantis and had an advanced civilization well over 10,000 years ago. Still, when we put the evidence on the table, and I'm having this the article that I wrote that's posted on my site called Place of the Gods sent to Sitchin right now for him to take a look at, if he will. And I'm really hoping to open up this conversation. In fact, I'll be in Kempton, Illinois on May 5th and 6th conferring with Chris Dunn and David Hatcher Childress about this as well. So really trying to get a dialogue going on this possibility here.
Chris Dunn believing that the pyramids of Giza are power plants.
Absolutely. Without a doubt. Imagine you could shrink yourself down to the size of a pea and crawl inside a modern Corvette engine. That's the feeling that you get when you go inside the Great Pyramid. You're inside a vast, powerful, smoking engine that is utterly, utterly, unimaginably powerful.
These stargates that we're talking about that open up these portals either throughout the universe or who knows where, maybe other dimensions. Did anybody ever mention the possibility that demons could come through them?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I am tracking these beings that I know you've talked about recently called Archons.
Yes.
I've been writing about them since 2002, 2003, beginning an Oracle of the Illuminati, identifying these Archon beings that were written about and talked about by the Gnostics and the earliest Christians. They are equated with the gray aliens. They are known as the Watchers. I believe that one of the tasks that they have assigned to themselves is they are guardians of these portals. As I wrote in my book, The Illuminator, about Mary Magdalene, she was given specific knowledge by Jesus after the resurrection concerning the language of the Archons and how to evade the Archons in the soul's quest to return to the source.
William, in the work that you were doing when you went there and you started to tie it into the solar eclipse, did you also look into our own moon and its ramifications on the planet?
I did. I had to. It's something that I hadn't paid a great deal of attention to before, but here I am preparing to go experience a total solar eclipse of the sun, which meant that I had to learn a little bit something about our planet's interaction with the moon. And I learned that there's this amazing debate going on about what exactly is the moon. Is the moon, in fact, an artificial satellite? Because science says that the likelihood that an Earth-like planet like ours should have such a large moon is incredibly, incredibly small. And so we have to begin to look for some kind of an accounting of how this came to be.
Well, I think maybe it was formed when an object smashed into the planet. What do you think?
Well, that's certainly one of the hypotheses, that the moon was formed independently from the same cloud of dust and gas as the Earth, or that it was once part of the Earth, or perhaps even part of a former planet called Tiamat that existed in our solar system.
What is your belief system?
I believe that the moon is an artificial Earth satellite that was put into orbit by advanced beings who had a technology exactly like we're beginning to imagine today with our nanotechnology and our advanced physics, but which we are not quite capable of duplicating yet.
That's a John Lear theory as well. He believes the moon was towed into its present orbit?
Well, I think that's a pretty reasonable speculation. I'll also go along with John Lear's notion concerning the possible purpose of the moon. Other than to regulate the tides on Earth and to enable land masses to be formed on this planet and therefore life to evolve on land, the ancients clearly believed that the moon was a gate for souls. They viewed the moon as the home of the dead, as a female gate through which souls passed on the way to the paradise field of the stars.
Isn't it interesting that the Giza pyramids are all tied into that too?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that you have to just be blown away by that. In fact, what I came to was the notion that the Earth-Moon system is, in fact, a vast temple for our soul's growth. The Great Pyramid is the spiritual hub of this planet. It's located at the exact geographical center of the land masses of the Earth. And it's believed to be part of a worldwide pyramid system created in prehistory that's mounted like an antenna on key energy meridians on our planet, which were employed by the ancient pre-scientists as a musical system to stabilize the tectonic plates of this planet, assisting in allowing life to evolve on land. And this brings up an interesting pun. Ancient Egypt was called Mer or Mera, which meant beloved land.
The possibilities that the moon was towed into its orbit by extraterrestrials, I would assume. What was the? I mean, did they know that we needed a moon for other purposes, or do you think it's like the starship in Star Wars, the
Death Star,
the Death Star, exactly?
Yeah. I think it's actually both, George, because the moon and plate tectonics is what is unique about Earth. What is unique about the Earth is that it has liquid water, both fresh and seawater and land. And this is because if the moon had not carried away most of the crust from the Pacific basin, presumably, there would be no ocean basins, no land, and no chance for life to evolve on land. Earth would be a water world. You and I would not be having this conversation.
Well, if we did, we'd be talking with bubbles in our mouth. Huh?
Yeah, we'd be dolphin speak or whale speak.
The Dolphin Show with William Henry. Well, of everything that you investigated on this trip, was there one thing that just knocked you out?
Well, a lot of things, really, but primarily it gets back to Abu Ghraib and this idea that there was this ancient place of the gods, and that it's still intact and it's there to be studied. Now, I, again, am tying this in with Atlantis, which was the secondary mission that I had on this trip, was to look at the ancient Egyptian beliefs concerning this island civilization created by formless beings that came from the stars and created civilization on Earth. That's the Atlantis story. And it's one that is not often discussed, but which I think is definitely worthy of consideration.
I think so, too, William. As a matter of fact, let's devote some time to it next hour.
Beautiful.
We'll get your tape on Atlantis and how it ties into Egypt. Very possible that those Atlanteans went to Egypt a long time ago.
Ah, yes, that one's dedicated to all you ladies who listen to Coast AM. Well, we'll be back with William Henry, who has him chasing him all over the place whenever he goes to conferences, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. William, I want to get back to talking about your belief in the possibility of extraterrestrial life coming to this planet, especially in the Egyptian area, but also Atlantis as well. First of all, give me your take on who you believe the Atlanteans were, where they may have originated, and what happened to them.
I subscribe wholeheartedly to Plato's description of Atlantis, which was a civilization founded by the gods who came from the stars. Zeus, we're told, in Plato's tale, dwelled at the center of the universe, which could well be the center of our Milky Way galaxy, or it could even be a far more distant center. Either way, these gods came to Earth, created a hybrid race of god-men that were imputed with a divine essence, according to Plato. Over time, this divine essence began to wane. This is why Zeus all of a sudden went ballistic, and we experienced the wrath of Zeus, hence the destruction of Atlantis. So I think based upon Plato's story that Atlantis was founded by star beings, extraterrestrials who came to this place to create life, to enable the growth of the human race.
And you believe it was out there in the Atlantic? Edgar Cayce, of course, says in the Bimini area, Plato had a different view.
Well, right. But the key to me is this red granite, the use of megalithic red granite in these constructions. And you see evidence of the same construction in Egypt, both beside Abydos at the Osirian. You see it at the Valley Temple beside the Sphinx. You see it in Malta. You see it in South America. And it appears that Atlantis was, in fact, a global civilization. Where the exact center of Atlantis was located, that's still very much open to question.
Well, I got to tell you, the myth of Atlantis has been something that I have been fascinated with. I wish we could find exactly where that area is and just get some artifacts. You know, we've talked about the Bimini Bridge, the road. Mm-hmm. Edgar Cayce again says it's going to raise. Mm-hmm. I would love to find that area.
Well, let me share something with you that I think is very important that became clear as a bell to me, clear as crystal on this past trip. There is definitely a mental component to this whole Atlantis story. The story of Atlantis is what has been described as a meme, spelled M-E-M-E, which is like a catchphrase, a catch tune. It's a code word that enables access to other knowledge and even other dimensions of being. And it became absolutely apparent to me that to truly appreciate the heightened awareness of Egypt and even to connect with the true story of Atlantis, and these star beings, call them extraterrestrials, in order to appreciate them and achieve their heightened awareness, both sides of the brain must be used. And I wanted to offer, I shared on the site there in Atlantis, Egypt, Plate 2, a phenomenal mandala that was painted by another guest on our trip. Her name's Anya Nadal. She creates these amazing paintings that are a form of visual meditation that combine colors and sacred geometry to put the brain in exactly the heightened state of awareness that I'm describing. And simply, if the listeners will go to the site and, as we're talking, if they have access to the internet, gaze at this mandala and see for themselves how their brain waves will begin to synchronize in a heightened state of awareness. And the reason I bring this up too, George, is because Anya describes that she has a being, which she calls an Atlantean fairy, in the center of this mandala. And to me, this is one doorway that will help any individual who isn't a meditator just to spend a few moments gazing at this and allow the imagery here to drive the brain into this heightened state of awareness. I really came to the awareness that this is a key to unlocking not only the mysteries of ancient Egypt, but also especially of Atlantis.
Were these messages in her book given to her by anybody, or were these just her writings of a researcher?
Well, they're paintings, and her book is called Holographic Mandala. And she's got half a dozen or more paintings in here that you actually put on 3D glasses. I'll send you a copy next week.
Okay, I'd like to see that.
Amazing experience, George. I mean, you put these 3D glasses on, and all of a sudden these shapes start moving before you, the colors begin to shift. And before you know it, you're in this heightened state of awareness. And that, again, is the true key to all of this, is being able to connect with this knowledge that is ever present on our planet.
And do you believe those Atlanteans who fled the area made it to Egypt?
I believe that they did. That's why I call Egypt the shadow of Atlantis. And this means no disrespect whatsoever to the ancient Egyptian indigenous tradition. It's the way I tracked this story. And if you don't like the word Atlantis, that's okay, because I believe that most people understand Atlantis to be a meme or a catchphrase for an advanced civilization that existed deep in prehistory. And if you don't agree with that name, that's okay. But the fact of the matter is, George, that this place name, Atlantis, and another place name that goes along with it, Tula, appear over and over and over again throughout our planet, whether you're in Mexico, Mongolia, or any other continent. You're going to find this place name, and attached to it is the story of a devastating cataclysm that destroyed a previous civilization of which there were survivors who carried this name and place name throughout the planet.
You know, it's so amazing, William, with all their great technology, they could not stop this.
Well, I mean, that's where we get back to our conversation about Dr. Paul LaViolette and the tremendous power of the center of our Milky Way galaxy, and this notion that Atlantis was destroyed when a galactic superwave pile-drived the planet and wiped it out. I mean, we're talking about the effect of a boot kicking a marble, basically. I mean, it's just something you would have to have just astoundingly unimaginable technology in order to deflect something like that. But in fact, the ancient Egyptian myths and legends in the Edfu text, called the Building Text, do refer to these formless beings as utilizing relics, utilizing what I call power tools in an attempt to assuage the effects of whatever cataclysm it was that destroyed the first island civilization.
You know, the fact that some of them fled, they escaped. Some of them went to Central America, South America. Some of them went to Egypt. They were scattered all throughout the regions because there's too many similarities of buildings and markings and things like that. So they travel all over the place. The mindset that they had, though, the knowledge that they had, how were they able to teach that to, let's say, ancient Egyptians or the Mayans or whoever they did?
Well, they introduced very simple symbol systems, and they utilized symbols and even geometry in the temple constructions that they built as these teaching tools. In this way, they knew that a stone structure carries this knowledge within it, inherent within its architecture, and also within the experience that the soul engages in when it truly unfolds itself before one of these temples. They were masters at communicating knowledge at a very deep and spiritual level, not necessarily communicating this knowledge through books or papyruses or other tangible forms.
You know, William, do you have other people who support some of these views? Are you out there all by yourself?
What I'm doing is collecting a variety of thoughts that support this viewpoint. It's totally groundbreaking in many senses, but it's based upon years and years of research that has gone on by other researchers. I mean, I cited, for example, the oral tradition of ancient Egypt that Stephen Mailer is researching, and the story that I'm talking about now in terms of the Edfu text comes from another scholar, Dr. Yves Raymond. So basically, this is not something that I'm initiating myself. Rather, what I'm doing is putting the puzzle together in a slightly different way.
So were you satisfied with your trip? Do you think you came back with some information that you can use for the future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, solid boots-on-the-ground research there at Abu Ghraib, photographic evidence of what we're talking about, that is, again, on the coast site tonight. But again, most importantly, this understanding that it's a possibility for every individual to place themselves in, quote-unquote, resonance with this knowledge that is ever present. And it's not just in Egypt where we hear this story. Rennes Le Château, they tell the same story there, that when Jesus and Mary Magdalene came to southern France, they deposited sacred knowledge in the landscape. This is a well-known and often cited capability that the ascended beings, the masters of the East, are capable of doing. They can take vast realms of knowledge, vast amounts of knowledge, and literally download it into a statue or a stone, so that those who are sensitive enough, who have developed their psychic faculties and their intuition, are capable of interacting on a vibrational level with that knowledge. It's sort of like a CD player, really, for them, George. I mean, they download the knowledge onto the CD, and if you have the internal mechanism, the internal apparatus to be able to access or play that CD, the knowledge of the universe is open to you.
Do you think it's entirely possible that the information about Atlantis and the technology from Atlantis has already been found, let's say, by governments who have just kept it quiet?
Oh, I'm totally convinced of that. One of my earliest books was called One Foot in Atlantis, The Secret Occult History of World War II, in which I chronicled Adolf Hitler and FDR's quest for these very secrets.
Was it a race?
Absolutely, without a doubt. World War II was a total occult war, which was a race between two conflicting and also competitive visions of the new Atlantis. Would it be Hitler's master race version of Atlantis, or would it be FDR's melting pot version of Atlantis, which is ultimately, I feel, what won out? You know, there are others that would argue with me that, hey, you know, really the Nazis and the Americans just got together and voila, we have our present set of circumstances, but that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah, well, that sure is. So, all right, so you go to Egypt, you come back. Tell me about the National Geographic work and what's going to happen with it.
Well, it was, again, a tremendous experience. It was really on-the-job training for me. The cameraman that was assigned, his name was Rich Confalone. Are you familiar with that History Channel show, Digging for the Truth?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
sure
Josh Bernstein show, Digging for the Truth. Mm-hmm. Rich is Josh's cameraman.
Okay.
And has traveled all over the world with Josh. And so it was really a great experience for me to be able to work with a cameraman who directs Josh and to get a little insight into how that show works and all that Josh has to go through in order to put those shows together. And Rich, again, has gone to, you name it, Easter Island, Nazca, Egypt, India, and he, too, agreed he has never been to a stranger or even more magical place than Abu Ghraib.
What about the people there? Did you like them?
The people at Abu Ghraib or
yeah.
In Egypt? Yeah, absolutely. It's really pretty wild, George. I mean, the site is accessed through a very thick mango grove. And we're driving along as we're entering, and almost out of nowhere, like some invisible door opens, here comes this temple keeper, who just slips in front of us and say, let us know, hey, we're here. This is our job is to watch over and protect this site. And they gave us basically carte blanche there the first time that I went. I went three times. But after a while, I don't know if Zahi, you know, was flying over and, you know, in his hawk self or whatever. But
he says, there's William Henry. Get him out of there.
Yeah, exactly. The alarm sounds, and they're like, hey, it's time for you guys to leave, like, now. And so that kind of created a little bit of a situation for us. And then, as I mentioned, we went back again with the group, and I went back a third time with another local person, and you know, you basically feel like you're in an episode of The Sopranos when you're in Egypt, because you have to carry a wad of cash and you just pay everybody off along the way.
Oh, that's true. That is. Now, how much do you have to pay to buy somebody off to get in here or get in there? $5, $10, $20.
Yeah, you know, usually I'm a little bit generous with my tips, so I would pay a little bit more than that, which isn't a considerable amount of money, but in Egypt it goes a long way. And so I paid around $50 or so for my third trip, just as a tip. And but the thing is that we weren't there. I was there meditating for about 30 minutes or so, and all of a sudden the sheriff comes running up. This guy reminded me a lot of Saddam Hussein, and if not for having the local people with me, one of the gentlemen calls himself Mr. No Problem. He said, hey, I'm Mr. No Problem. Anything you want here in Abu Ghraib, you let me know. And he invited me back to come back and have a barbecue, spend the night, have a barbecue, listen to some Bedouin music, watch the stars and all that kind of thing, which I hope to take him up on. But it was pretty tense there for a minute when the sheriff comes racing up and he's got this real Saddam Hussein attitude. And it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, this is not cool. You really need to be getting out of here.
Yeah, do you think Zahi sent him?
I have no idea. I mean, it's a possibility, but I mean, because they literally just came out of nowhere, and I had no idea how they even knew that we were there, because I essentially went in very early in the morning. We were being very quiet, and you go in and you meet the temple keepers, the temple guards, and you share, you know, a couple of laughs with them, and they let you go. And then all of a sudden, wow, you know, here comes thunder. And afterward, everything turned out fine, and it's a custom that you'll have a glass of tea with them, and it's just a way of thanking them for allowing you to come onto their temple site.
Did they ask you why you were there?
No. No, in fact, the gentleman who took me said for me not to even mention that I was there to meditate, or don't mention the word pray, nothing like that. Just tell them you're there to take pictures. And so that was the reason I went there. But I went there just because it was probably the single most peaceful place I've ever been on the planet. I've never felt more at home than at this place, sitting on top of this pyramid by myself, trying to make the quote-unquote cosmic connection with whatever energy is still inherent within the place.
Did they ever talk about how they thought the pyramids were built, even there?
No. I mean, George, you really just don't want to hear it. About the 10th time they tell you that they built a ramp and hauled these blocks up this ramp, you're like, yeah, right, whatever. And so we actually started to challenge them and asking questions. A gentleman on the trip is a builder who is very familiar with moving large objects around and was really asking the right questions of these guides about, hey, come on, tell us how this really happened.
I really would have loved to have had someone just to tell you the straight scoop.
I'm convinced they have the straight scoop too, George, and that's what's frustrating. Is I feel deep within that they have already probably, quote unquote, I use that expression a lot, but I think they've already looted the Hall of Records. I think they have.
I knew that. See, I always believed that too, a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, long since cleaned out. It's been carted off to who knows where, and maybe one day we'll have access to that. Not likely anytime soon.
Or they sold it to who knows where.
You hear that too? Absolutely.
Yeah. William, stay with us. We're going to open up Fast Blasts next. We'll take those questions for William Henry on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we'll open up the phone lines next hour for William Henry's magical mystery tour throughout Egypt. But when we come back, I think I'll go to Fast Blast. We'll take those questions next on Coast to Coast AM. William Kirk from Green Bay, Wisconsin, wants to know that besides the pyramids being made of stone or limestone, what are the similarities between the various pyramids that you have seen?
Oh, that's a very good question. The primary similarity that you have is this notion that they are all part of an interconnected grid that is capable of transmitting energy and possibly even acting sort of like a radio system to relay information. So from that standpoint, what we're looking at here is not individual pyramids, but rather an entire grid that is, as I noted earlier, a form of a musical system, in fact.
Do you share Christopher Dunn's views
that the pyramids of Giza could be power plants?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, shrink yourself down to the size of a pea, crawl inside a Corvette engine, and you have a similar feeling to walking in the Grand Gallery, the ascending passage there into the pyramid and on into those chambers. I have the distinct intuition when you're there, even apart from Chris Dunn's incredible work, that we're dealing with an immensely, immensely powerful machine. And I certainly go along with this notion that this machine was capable of transmitting and receiving energies from the stars, from the sun, the moon, and then transmitting that energy throughout the planet.
Ryan from Texas wants to know if you think the folks who put together the Stargate shows had any inside knowledge or picked things up from you.
Well, I can't say for sure that they have. I do know other writers. I have a nice acquaintance. His name is David Titcher, who wrote a series for TNT called The Librarian. And in it, he references the language of the birds, and that's he told me is a tip-off to me. So I know that David has utilized some of my research, and I certainly appreciate that. I think his stuff is wonderful. And by the way, he's got a new Librarian series, new installment in that series coming out on TNT pretty soon. So I wouldn't be surprised if others are using it. I know other researchers certainly have used my material in the past, which is absolutely fine. I just would prefer that they cite me as a reference, if for no other reason than to provide an information trail for interested parties to be able to go to the source of the information and better evaluate what they're receiving.
What do you think the climate was like 10,000 years ago in that region?
Well, by all estimates, we were dealing with a paradisical world, a lush garden. When we're standing at Abu Ghraib, which is presently what appears to be a lunar or desert wasteland, we have to imagine that there was water everywhere, that we're sitting or standing in a lush garden, very tropical, very beautiful, very fruitful. And the picture that we get of the pyramid, which is certainly today in such a decrepit state, was that it was originally covered with these beautiful red granite casing stones. It probably had water running down the sides of it, and in every way, shape, and form is one of the most beautiful sights you can imagine, and would be a place that I would certainly like to return to.
Remind me, by the way, before you're off the air with me tonight, William, to get your take on the new gospel that has been discovered, the Gospel of Judas.
Mm-hmm.
Get your take on that a little bit later on.
Okay.
Do you have views on that?
I love it. I am ecstatic. This is just what the doctor ordered. It's time for the revelation of the true secrets that Jesus revealed to Judas, according to this gospel, and also to Mary Magdalene. It is absolutely critical that this knowledge come forth, because it's going to be the knowledge that will enable us to defeat the darkness that is presently trying to envelop our planet. There is a war going on right now, and it's not just a war on terror. It's much, much bigger than that.
Is it an angelic war as well?
It's a war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness that has immense cosmic consequences, and it's time that each of us begin to stand up and really fully engage all of our spiritual capacities to flip this situation. We don't have to settle for maniacs with nuclear weapons trying to blow this planet to smithereens. It's time we ran them out of here, and those that are controlling them, I'm convinced, are not on this planet.
Now, that's an interesting take. I do believe that they're being controlled, but I've never taken the planet, the extraterrestrial approach.
Well, yeah. When you go back to President Bush's inaugural speech in the year 2000, does the angel in the whirlwind still direct this storm? He asked that question three times in a 12-minute speech. The angel in the whirlwind are called the Watchers, and the Watchers are known as the Archons and the gray aliens. He's telling us straight up that these Archon Watchers control and direct this storm on Earth. And then in the 2004 Republican National Convention, he stood in the symbol of Atlantis and talked about liberty being a concept that comes from those from beyond the stars. What's he talking about? He's talking about stellar influences on this planet And our president is a pawn to these stellar influences.
And you're a believer in symbols as well, aren't you?
Oh, totally. Symbols are everything in terms of communicating and transmitting ancient knowledge.
Justin wants to know from Los Angeles if you are familiar with The Gods of Eden by William Bramley.
Absolutely love that book. I met William Bramley in 1991 when that book came out. He's actually got a new book out now called Jesus Goes to Hollywood that I hope he gets some play on as well.
So you agree with that theory on Eden?
Absolutely. I mean, his primary premise is that the three major world religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and also Buddhism, were set up by an extraterrestrial force in order to generate conflict on this planet. They've been very successful at it.
Peggy would like you to elaborate a little bit more about the Archons, is it? She's from Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is a subject that I first learned about, back 2002, 2003, when I was doing research on the Nag Hammadi Library. These are scrolls and texts that were preserved by the early Gnostics, and these were the actual books that the living Jesus and the disciples would have been working with as well. And in these texts, one in particular called the Hypostasis of the Archons, also subtitled The Reality of the Rulers, it spells out plainly that there is an extraterrestrial force, a predatory force called Archons, that are jealous of a divine essence that humanity possesses. We have it, they don't, they want ours, and they have set up this material world as a distraction in order to keep us in a fear, on a fear farm, so that they can harvest an energy from us.
That's not my perspective.
That's what this book says.
Izzy from Montclair, New Jersey, wants to know if, let's see here, how do you explain the slave ruins surrounding the pyramids if the pyramids were built by extraterrestrials or at least helped by them?
Well, the whole thing here is the word that I use is that the pyramids and these other monuments were made in the ancient world. And I intentionally use that word made because it refers to something that is manufactured or created. But made is also a police term for identified. So if a policeman makes your car, he didn't manufacture it, he identifies your car. And I believe that what happened is that these temples were made by the gods and later made or identified as sacred sites by various pharaohs and other regimes who then came in and assigned their own names to their construction and took credit for the creation of these monuments, although they probably had nothing whatsoever to do with them. So slave quarters around the pyramid, why not? Who's to say that those slave quarters were actually for the people that originally made the pyramid? Why couldn't they be condos for people that moved in later?
True. Ian from New York, what do you think of crystals? Do they work? Do they hold knowledge?
Well, I'm very fascinated by crystals. I have studied Mount Ida, Arkansas intensively, which is a source of the purest quartz crystal on the planet. I keep rocks around me. I pick up rocks everywhere I go. I don't consider myself necessarily a rock hound, but I do subscribe to this notion based upon Eastern tradition that the Tertons, the wise beings, the sages of the past had a capability of downloading knowledge into quartz crystal, just like we can download knowledge onto a CD and retrieve that knowledge by placing themselves in harmonic resonance with those crystals.
Frederick from Ohio wants to know if there's any mathematical relationship to the position and location of the pyramids and the Sphinx.
Well, that I don't know. But what I could share with you, if you would like, is a brief meditation concerning the moon in the pyramid. Would you like that?
Yeah, now, and tell me about that. What does that mean?
Okay. Imagine drawing a pyramid or a triangle with the same base angle as the Great Pyramid, 51 degrees, 51 minutes. Now, in your imagination, draw a circle with its center and diameter the same as the base of the large triangle. And let this represent the circumference of the Earth. Next, in your imagination, draw a square that touches the outside of that Earth circle, and draw a second circle around the first one with its circumference equal to the perimeter of the square. This is what the Freemasons call squaring the circle. This new circle will pass exactly through the apex of the pyramid. And now here's the wow, George. A circle drawn with its center at the apex of the pyramid and its radius just long enough to touch the Earth circle will have the circumference of the moon. The Earth-Moon system, and then the pyramid, is a hologram of this Earth-Moon system. Whoever built the pyramid, and it's ascribed in Egyptian tradition to the moon god Thoth, knew about our relationship with the moon. I believe that the moon is, in fact, the missing capstone to the pyramid.
The whole moon?
The whole moon. The pyramid, its geometry is pointing directly to the moon. Its designer was the moon god. And we find all of these incredible references to that are just very obscure to the Great Pyramid and the moon itself.
That's a good, interesting analogy, too. Candy wants to know if you believe that the Egyptians themselves might have been alien.
Well, we're all aliens when you think about it. And the question is whether or not you allow yourself to be part of the larger human race, or if you want to segregate yourself and say, I am an Egyptian. Well, that is, in my view, a limiting view. We have to open up to this idea. Even the Bible says that we were created by an extraterrestrial force of sorts. We're not indigenous to this planet. Our souls, according to the shamanic tradition, came from the center of our Milky Way galaxy or through the center of the galaxy, and we are temporarily inhabiting this temple of souls that is composed of the Earth, Moon, Sun system.
I find it fascinating, William, how the Catholic Church seems to be spending more and more time with extraterrestrial theories, devoting also several key members of the Vatican to investigate this or head it up.
Now we're talking. We're finally having a conversation. We're finally getting a little bit of understanding, a little bit of flexibility on these issues. And if this continues, hey, it won't be long before we no longer have these religious wars, that we're going to be achieving instead a galactic perspective. We're going to see ourselves as citizens, not just of this planet way out here on the Orion arm of our galaxy, but in fact, citizens of the whole galaxy. And when you look back at the Earth from the perspective of the center, all these meaningless differences that we jealously guard evaporate.
We're going to have Whitley on the program when one of his books becomes another movie on the alien grays.
Oh, the grays. Yeah, great.
It's going to be a great. Did anybody ever talk about that on your trips to Egypt in terms of what these beings might have looked like?
Oh, absolutely, because first of all, most of us were astute to the Nag Hammadi Library and the presence of the Archons, very inspired, especially lately by your conversation with John Lash. And in fact, I had interviewed him on Dreamland as well. But also, we have these strange depictions or descriptions of these formless beings that may even have been beings of light. And I say that because in Wally Budge's Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary, which scholars really don't like that much anymore, but still, in that book, he says that one of the names of the Great Pyramid was Akut, which means light, glorious light, or shining one. But it's interesting, George, that Akut, according to Budge, also means beings of light, i.e., wise, instructed folk. And when you put that together, it formulates the question, did beings of light, wise, instructed folk, truly beam themselves to this planet long ago and then took human form? That's what the Edfu texts say, the building texts at the Temple of Edfu. It clearly says, according to Dr. Yves Raymond, which again is subject to individual interpretation and controversy, but it still says that the original beings who came to this planet and founded civilization were light beings who took human form.
That is fascinating. It is fascinating how various civilizations will all talk about the same thing.
Yeah. Think of the movie Cocoon. That's, I think, the type of beings that we're describing here. Beings of light that temporarily took human form. Very poignant story, and I think tripping on what may have been the actual truth in the ancient, ancient world.
And it's all energy, too, isn't it?
Exactly. And so are you and I.
William, what's new on your plate in terms of DVDs or books?
Well, I've got this my three-lecture series from Egypt, about 6 hours of talks called Egypt, The Shadow of Atlantis. I'm very happy with these. I have some very demanding critics that travel with me, and I'm happy to say that they said, hey, you know, a couple of these are some of your best lectures. So I feel quite proud of that.
Don't you love those critics?
Oh, I do. I mean, they're quite blunt, too, and it's like, okay, you know, you just drop the ego and take it as a hint that you can always improve, and that's what I'm constantly looking for is ways to improve and ways to get more insight into these ancient mysteries.
And, of course, your website, williamhenry.net, mm-hmm. correct?
Yes.
Still stays
Thank
the
you.
Same.
Yes.
Very good. You get a lot of hits, don't you?
I do, and again, I'm grateful for each and every one of them and wish I could interact more than I can, but I do the best job I can.
And what's new with conferences coming up?
I got a string of them. I'm going to Naples, Florida, April 28th. Then I go to Kempton, Illinois for David Hatcher Childress's conference with Chris Dunn. I'm having my own conference here in Nashville, June 17th. I'm ecstatic, George. We've got the Quest for Immortality exhibit coming to the Frist Museum here in Nashville. It's the largest collection of Egyptian artifacts outside of Egypt. And so I put together a one-day conference on June 17th that will include a tour of the Quest for Immortality exhibit as well as the Parthenon and the Bicentennial Mall complex here in downtown Nashville that I call Stargate Park.
You think we'll ever find immortality, William?
I think we're one generation away from it. I think we are dead on, true blue, aimed at transforming the human body into a vehicle that will be capable of expanded life 100, 200 years, easy, easy, easy.
William, when we come back, let's get your take then on this new gospel, the Gospel of Judas, and get your views on it. I know a lot of people are upset about this gospel being found. They don't believe it, but that's part of the luxury. You don't have to believe it. We'll be back with William Henry, and next hour we'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And our guest, William Henry, we're going to take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, William, before we go to the vast calls, let's get your take on the Gospel of Judas. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm ecstatic. I mean, traditional Christianity says it's not truly good news. Well, I think it's truly phenomenal news because what we're beginning to see is this steady stream of new knowledge. I mean, this manuscript claims that Jesus revealed secret knowledge to Judas.
Or Jedi, you never know.
Same name. You know, Gnostic beliefs hold that secret and personal insights are the key to redemption, and this is a Gnostic text, and this is why traditional Christianity is opposed to it, because it says that this secret knowledge or personal insight, rather than faith in Jesus' resurrection, is the key to our ultimate salvation. And this is why they're saying it's not theologically true. Well, that's a person's opinion. This is the key to this whole argument, that there was this secret esoteric Christian tradition that has been wiped out through mass murder and through control and manipulation. An example that I often cite, which is really kind of the keystone image or keystone quote that I operate from, comes from another book that has been discredited, another Gnostic text called the Pistis Sophia. In this text, in response to a question posed by Mary Magdalene, Jesus says, cease not to seek day and night, and remit not yourselves until you find the purifying mysteries, which will purify you and make you into a refined light, so that you will go on height and inherit the light of my kingdom. This is the exact knowledge the archons and controllers do not want us to possess, because once we have this knowledge, we are capable of enormous spiritual feats and capable, in fact, of leaving this realm permanently.
To the phones we go, east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, thanks. Well, first I'd like to say that I pretty much agree with William's thoughts on the book of Judas, but I disagree with him thinking that by everyone finding out the truth of where, you know, extraterrestrial intelligence, that it calls everyone to, you know, forget about their own religions and unite together. And I was wondering if he thinks that the only reason that government and world leaders haven't revealed the truth of extraterrestrial intelligence is to essentially protect religions.
That's a very good question, and I completely understand that viewpoint, and at times go along with it. I do believe that there is a beneficent purpose behind this from time to time, that there are those that think they're our father, and they want to protect us lowly children. But that only goes so far. When you resort then to protecting this knowledge by mass murder and genocide, you've stepped over onto the side I call evil. And unfortunately, that's what religious organizations have been doing for centuries upon centuries. Millions upon millions of people have been literally exterminated by organized religion to prevent these ultimate secrets from being revealed. And if that's a method of protection, so be it. I don't think so, though, but I can understand your argument.
Okay, thanks for calling. Let's move next to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dalton. I'm a truck driver in Oklahoma.
Sure, Dalton.
And I was just wondering if he had kind of a quick synopsis, you know, in light of everything that's going on in the world in reference to the Bible and even the gospel according to Judas there, and the, you know, the last few guests that you've had on, if he had like a synopsis of, you know, to kind of tell us what his beliefs are, you know, along those kind of lines.
All right. Well, do you want to share that with us, William?
Be happy to. I believe that that Jesus and the other apostles were hardcore esoteric researchers. They scoured Iran, Iraq, Egypt, India, Mongolia, seeking knowledge from the ancient world, even pre-flood knowledge that concerned the methods by which the latent knowledge within human DNA can be accessed, knowledge that ultimately affects the transformation of an ordinary human into an immortal being. The image that the Egyptians provide, they portray Osiris, the god of resurrection, who compares very favorably to Jesus. They portray Osiris in a pupil form, a very nice pun, because pupil, when spelled P-U-P-I-L, means student. When spelled P-U-P-A-L, means cocoon. So they portray him as a student cocoon who is looking for the secrets that will enable his transformation, his metamorphosis, if you will, from a cocoon into a butterfly, so that then he can become a Stargate walker and travel the paradise field of the stars.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
My question for William is if he's familiar with the Rosicrucian Order headquartered in San Jose, and what he thinks like their views are and what they're all about.
Yeah, I am familiar with it. My primary window on that, again, is Stephen Mailer, who's been intimately involved with that organization for a number of years. I think that they have done a tremendous job in attempting to, once again, assimilate this data from the ancient world. I'm very excited about this Quest for Immortality exhibit that's coming to Nashville this summer. And the reason why is because what they're going to do is recreate the tomb, the burial tomb of Thutmose III, an Egyptian pharaoh and initiate who is credited with the Rosicrucians as being the founder of the Rosicrucians and the founder of the Illuminati. So his treasure, his tomb, his stuff is coming to Nashville this summer, and I'm ecstatic because when you go to Egypt, when you go to the Valley of the Kings, you're given about 45 minutes to do intensive research, on these tombs. Well, come to Nashville, see the tombs with me this summer. We'll spend all day walking through there, and we'll look at it, and we'll absolutely study it in detail. It's going to be I'm just ecstatic at this opportunity to get a firsthand look at the stuff that belonged to the founder of the Rosicrucians and the Illuminati.
Okay, no follow-up?
No.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Idrissa Walker calling from Orlando, Florida.
Hi, Idrissa. Go ahead.
Hey, I was wondering, is this the same William Henry that wrote that has the documentary Lost Science of the Soul, Breaking the Reptilian Code?
Yes.
Wow. You're deep.
It's him.
You are extremely deep.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, a lot of people should check that out and memorize some of the imagery that you brought up there, because I've even noticed some of it in tarot cards, and it just pops up everywhere. Even when you watch, like, History Channel, you see massive amounts of that imagery, especially with the serpents. Every culture has the serpents.
You're right, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because it enables me to talk about a project I'm working on right now. I'm creating a site called Cosmic Kindergarten. And the purpose of it, I'm using a character I created named Junior Cosmic Egg. It's the story of a cosmic egg named Junior who grows up to become his own universe. And what I'm going to do is create a children's metaphysical workshop. You know, when we grow up, we're taught the alphabet, but we're never, ever, ever taught the meaning of the alphabet, where the letter A came from in its symbolic sense and its connection throughout the planet. We're never, ever taught the meaning of symbols, even though we spend our whole lives swimming in a sea of symbols. And this is how the quote-unquote controllers are able to manipulate us, because they count on the total blindness of the average individual to the language of symbolism. So I've come up with a potential solution here. I'm going to create Cosmic Kindergarten and teach the language of symbolism to people of all ages. And I'm thinking it's going to be something that will ultimately help us to unify our language, our symbol system, and ultimately to help individuals connect with the power of these symbols.
William, I love that idea.
Well, thank you. Yeah, me too. It's something I've been working on for a while, and I hoped to have had something up on the site for this interview. I'm sorry I didn't, but at least I can make an announcement for it. So I thank you for that question.
Are you a believer in the multiverse, that there's more than one universe?
I'm totally a believer in that. The multiverse and the field, this is totally where it's at. In fact, in my lecture in Egypt, my second one, which is called Egyptian Stargate Metaphysics, The Dimension of the Blessed, I go into detail about the ancient Egyptian artwork that reflects this, not only the multiverse, but this field of quantum energy, this conscious, creative energy that embodies, that each of us embody and interact with.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. Your turn. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Sage. I'm calling from Oakland, Sage. California.
Okay, Sage, go ahead.
I wanted to respond to your theories regarding the moon, and you seem pretty confident about all, you know, the things you've been talking about, except for that one. And I wanted to share my theory that I know you're probably familiar with Eastern philosophy and the Golden Age, and that we're in an age of machine now.
Yes.
Okay, so what I think is that the moon was the old Earth, while this Earth that we're on was in the process of being created.
That's interesting.
Of course, before when it was a paradise, and that we're in the age of machine now, while a new Earth is being created.
Why do you believe this?
Well, I read a book called God Speaks. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
Yeah, sure have.
You have?
Yeah.
So that's actually where I got it from. I didn't make it happen.
You stole the theory.
But I really believe in that philosophy, and a lot of the Eastern philosophy of combination of Buddhist and Hindu theories of reincarnation and stuff, it feels so so real inside me that it's, you know, it's kind of like an explanation to where we go and why we're here. That's much more complex than heaven and hell, and, you know, you die and you just either go one way or the other, you know? And I thought, I'm sorry?
No, no, go ahead.
So, well, I'm glad to hear that you've heard of that book, God Speaks, because...
It's by Mahur Baba.
Yes.
Strange named author.
It's, it means compassionate father. It actually was given to him. It's not his birth name.
Ah, interesting. William, what's your take on all this?
Well, I think it's very interesting. It reminds me of Zechariah Sitchin's take that after this possible or alleged celestial cataclysm involving Tiamat, that the genetic seeds that were planted on the earth were imported from the moon. And so it suggests that idea. And then the other thought that I had as she was talking, that we're in this machine age and a new earth is being created. I would submit that new world that's being created is a virtual world. It's a cyber world that we're going to be creating it on what we presently call the internet, which is a portal or gateway into a three-dimensional hologram that we're in the process of creating. And that will ultimately be a place that's populated by avatars of ourselves that are aspects of ourselves that we probably can't even imagine existing at the moment, but which will be interacting with the avatars of other people in this invisible three-dimensional, but yet three-dimensional realm.
Do you still believe that there's a portal or a Stargate in Iraq?
I certainly do. Yes, absolutely. I'm more and more convinced of that, and we still don't have an explanation for why we went to Iraq, did we? I mean, it's the still... the biggest unanswered question, but yet when we look at the apocalyptic vision that's attempting to be purveyed on this planet and sold by the mass media, where we have evangelical Christianity lining up against radical Islam, it all lines up, because this whole idea of invading and destroying Babylon is one of the trigger events before the Messiah can return. Likewise, with Iran, they're looking at an apocalyptic scenario that will enable the return of the Mahdi. These people are nuts, and I'm really sick of it. And I'm hoping that we can all get our hearts and minds together and stop this nuclear conflagration that's about to unfold on this planet because of some mentally ill people who think they have the truth.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Chris. I'm calling from McAllen, Texas.
Sure, Chris. Go ahead.
I was wondering, William, if you know from the text of this this Gospel of Judas, whether or not the deity of Christ is brought up, or if it is even treated. That's my question. Also, one comment that I'd like to make about this this Gospel of Judas. Not all evangelical Christians have any fear toward this information, and you know, talking from my own perspective, I don't fear new information that comes out. I have no animosity toward anyone who espouses it. I am secure enough in what has already been written, and I believe in that as something that was divinely inspired. And yet, I also search for additional truths. As, you know, the apostles wrote, there is more than what was written in the Bible as truth. So at the same time, I can see that something new coming in is something that can be looked at from an objective viewpoint, yet not all of us are going to believe the same thing about it.
I love it, Chris. That's beautifully said, brother. I mean, that's exactly the whole point, isn't it? That we're asking questions here, and we're not saying we have the truth. We are still seeking the truth. And any shard of information that comes along, the shard of the original mirror that's going to enable us to have that insight or reflection that will transform us into the shining beings that we can become, we have to welcome. And by the way, I wanted to say hi to my friend Renita down there in McAllen, Texas. I was there back in January and had a lovely time, and hope to be able to come back down there. And maybe, Chris, you'll be able to pop into an event we have down there.
Nashville is a wonderful town, isn't it?
It's absolutely. It's, in my view, the new city of light. It is a replica of ancient Athens. We have a duplicate of the Parthenon from ancient Greece. We have the Temple of Mars here that was present in ancient Athens. And we have this amazing 2,200-foot-long magician's rod, this initiation temple that's laid out at the base of our state capitol. And I would love it if everybody would get in touch and pass through Nashville as soon as possible in order to help awaken what I am calling a temple of light.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with William Henry. Hi there. Hello. Go ahead. Well, we'll have to just disconnect. And
can I make a quick comment, George?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, on this Nashville question, one of my primary sources for upholding Nashville as this new city of light is Dr. J.J. Hertog in his book, The Keys of Enoch. He clearly states that Nashville, or actually a corridor running from Lexington, Kentucky to Nashville, Tennessee, is to be an Enlightenment center. And I'm highly, highly intrigued that Hertog also suggested that a second Enlightenment center would also be, quote-unquote, activated during the same time in the southwestern portion of the United States. And if you don't mind, I'd like to make this as a side note, this comment that this helps to explain what is animating this whole Mexican immigration wave right now. According to some, they're seeking to recreate what's called the Nation of Aztlan. And this Aztlan movement calls for the establishment of an independent nation composed of Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, and other portions of the Southwest.
And California, right?
And California. This is the fulfillment of prophecy of a new Aztlan, Atlantis, or Tula that would be created in the Southwest and also in the southeastern quadrant of the United States. So in my view, there's a much bigger issue unfolding here than protecting our borders. There is a movement to fulfill prophecy to create this new nation of Aztlan in the southwestern portion of the United States that is complemented, according to her talk.
Stay with us, William. Back with more. About a month ago, I got a small advance check on the book, Worker in the Light. And as I promised, part of those proceeds are going right back to Coast listeners. So some of those checks have gone out. And I know from some people who have emailed me back how delighted they are and, quite frankly, in shock that they were able to get that, but it has helped some people get through some really tough times. And that's what we're going to do. The book, Worker in the Light, comes out September 19th. It is now available on Amazon.com for pre-orders, and it is being discounted by Amazon.com. I don't know if I should tell you that, but it is, just to let you know that. And, you know, we'll just continue to use some of those proceeds that come in, and I'll just send out the checks on my own. This is not sanctioned through the network or anybody else. This is something I want to do for those Coast to Coast listeners who have been so supportive of the show and of me and of Art and Ian over all these years. And just our little way of saying thank you. I want to give back a little bit from what you have given us so much. But the book is called Worker in the Light by me and William Burns, B-I-R-N-E-S. You can find it on Amazon.com. They are taking the pre-orders now, even though you won't get the book until September 19th. And we are working on a book tour now. So there are some major cities that I will be going to in the not-too-distant future, beginning sometime in May. I've got to go to Washington, D.C. for a major book expo, which really will kick this thing off. And it's been a great, fun experience. And we're almost finished up. This one took a long time. And we're almost finished up with book number two. And I'm going to do the same thing. So also, thank you to our producer, our line producer at night, Tom Danheiser, who worked with me on his own time to accumulate so many of those emails that I received from some of our needy listeners. So thanks to all of you. And a few more months, it'll come out, and we'll see what all the book reviewers have to say. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with another noted author, historian, and investigative mythologist, William Henry, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let's go right back to the calls with our special guest, William Henry. Wildcard line, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, George.
Hey.
How are you?
Good.
First of all, I wanted to tell you that William is right. I have a book here, not right at my hand, but it showed the steps in Iraq that was to an old temple, and it led to a portal, they said, like long time ago. I'm going to find that book. But it just reminded me when he had mentioned it.
Okay.
Okay. And I wanted to ask William about John DePoe. He has the Coral Castle coat. He said he's got it broken.
How could he? This is incredible. I've never heard of this one.
Well, that's what I'm asking William. If he's on like his website and he's got pictures and clues of the way he said it's in ancient pictures of Christ. It's in the Last Supper picture, and I just want to know if he's been to his website and seen it. He said he doesn't know exactly how to put it together, I guess, but he said this is what Ed has left for, you know, the world to see. I mean, I looked at his website, and it's fascinating.
All right. You hold him back on us, William, and do you have the secrets to the Coral Castle?
No, I've glanced at the gentleman's site, and I'm highly intrigued by it, especially the way that, I mean, he has a very acute sense of pattern recognition and being able to perceive that the visual code or clues that Ed Lee Scallon left are, in fact, duplicated in the Church of Mary Magdalene at Rennes-le-Château and are, in fact, found in other pieces of art around the world. I do believe that there is this ancient sacred science that has been transmitted through symbols and in this visual code. Ed Lee Scallon did find it, and he does appear to have left those clues for us. I'm hoping to get down into that area soon and look at it firsthand, and maybe then I'll be in a better position to actually comment on that, because as I mentioned earlier, one of my life's quests now is to help to uncover this lost secret of anti-gravity and ironclad proof of this advanced sacred science and the means that we can utilize it today for peaceful purposes.
You should team up with William, Richard Hoagland, William, because he is fast on the trail as well. You two might find yourselves winning a Nobel Prize in Science, come up with that one.
We'll dedicate it to Coast AM. And by the way, George, congratulations on your book project. That is a beautiful concept. And please, by all means, let me know if there's anything I can do to assist you
in
the promotion.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll even turn the tables and I'll get to interview you on Dreamland or something.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I tell you, it took about a year longer than I thought it would to get out. And you know what it's like. But
always takes longer.
It's not easy. You know, I got into it first with an outline, and I found a literary agent in New York, and then they went to work with the publisher, and then Bill Burns came aboard with me, and I really thought it was going to be okay. Hey, this is fun, and man, it's a lot of work, especially when you're doing a full-time radio show and all these other projects.
Right. I mean, it totally taxes your imagination, your spiritual energy, but it's so worth it. And the cliches are all true. The journey is the reward. And now it's going to be, I think, an incredible ticket for you that's going to take you to places you probably have never even imagined possible before. So congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Let's go on to other callers with our guest, William Henry. Let's go to you, west of the Rockies. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from Monterey, California.
Sure, John. Go ahead, sir.
I'd like to ask your guest. He seems to have a lot of knowledge of Egypt.
And, he sure does.
I think it's interesting how back in the day, it seems you had two schools of thought, the Gnostics in Alexandria and the Christians in Rome, and obviously Rome won out. And it's kind of interesting to think about how the world might be different if the opposite were the case. But the underground stream of the mystery schools has continued to the present day with groups such as the Rosicrucians and the Masons. And it's interesting to note how they use principally Egyptian symbolism in their rituals and their teachings. But what I want to ask about is if your guest is familiar with Aleister Crowley's The Book of the Law and how it came to be that. The story is that he channeled it while he was in Egypt from someone who said they were an emissary of a particular Egyptian god.
I've heard about it, have not read it. William, what about you?
Right. I'm not as familiar with it as perhaps I should be to comment on it, other than to say that here is another prime example of this oral tradition that is gifted to individuals, channeled or downloaded in Egypt. There is something about the resonance of those temples that enables them to preserve and transmit not just energy, but also information. Yeah, I believe the reason they can do that is because this knowledge is already latent within our DNA, and all it awaits, like a flower needing sunshine, is that extra bit of energy in order for this knowledge to blossom from within.
That's interesting you say that, because as the story goes, Crowley one night somehow gained access to the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid, and to show off to his new wife, performed this ritual to invoke Horus. And as the story goes, over the next few days, his wife, who previously had no knowledge of anything esoteric, started to kind of jabber about messages being sent to her from this hawk-headed god. And that kind of led to Crowley investigating what she was talking about and using her as a seer, and eventually being a channel to supposedly write this book. And it all came about because he was in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid and supposedly channeled this energy, like you said, that may be just latent and waiting for somebody at the right time to come through.
That's a fascinating story.
It really is, and I can understand a little bit of it. Behind every great man is a great woman, and while in Egypt I was in the company of part of our group with an extraordinary woman that carried that kind of energy, and walking through the temples with her was heart chakra awakening. I have never experienced this kind of feeling before in my life. It was astounding, and I do believe that it is the magic, the mystery between a man and a woman that truly enables these mysteries to come forward, that it has to be the unity of the male and female as the circumstances where revelation can actually occur.
Let's go to our wild card line. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Roger from Westport, Washington.
Hello, Roger.
I spent 22 and a half years on the ocean fishing, and during that time, I had a lot of time to read, and I got into reading the Edgar Cayce files.
Sure.
Different readings. And in there, I mean, I have no exact numbers to give you or anything, but I remember specifically reading about Edgar Cayce said stone with the right resonance will float through air like metal floats through water, is how he said the pyramids were built. He also gave some readings on people that had witnessed flying saucers that were very upset. And in one I can remember, because this stuff's always interested me, he said that, told the guy not to worry because the flying saucer was from a planet from another universe smaller than ours, but these weren't ones you needed to worry about. You know, that it's something that's been happening for a long time and everything. But, I mean, I've tried to buy every book anybody ever wrote on him, and I still do. But I think you guys should look into that for some of the answers. I mean, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I really think it's something you should look into.
Now, William, I've been a fan of Edgar Cayce really for years. And, you know, he brings a different perspective to a lot of things that he did.
Oh, I agree. Again, I'm not a student, per se, of Edgar Cayce. Certainly respect the legacy.
Sure.
And am highly intrigued by so much of what he had to say, and one day hope to make it over there to the ARE and do some investigating personally.
Let's go to East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, this is Karen in Houston.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. Right off, I want to say thank you for what you do, both of you.
Sure.
To give credit where credit is due, I have a tie-in from some of my reading around between Da Vinci and, of course, Edgar Cayce and the Masonic. it all kind of ties in for me, the story of the Christ and Jesus, the man who became the Christ, and John the Baptist, who was the forerunner of him. And the way I understand it, the Great Pyramid was a place of initiation, and that's understood in the Masonic. And it seems that when John went there, Jesus was put through certain degrees, and the last of the degrees was for him to go and be baptized in the water, and that's when the Christ Spirit settled on him, which is a very ancient spirit in itself. It's so ancient, and it's been around, and every once in a while, it will light on the right person. And at the crucifixion, where Jesus is dying on the cross, and he cries out, "Eli, Eli, why have you forsaken me?" It's because that spirit had to leave him so that he could die. And then, of course, it returned later, and he was resurrected. But like Casey said, Jesus the one time, but the Christ forever. And there have been many Christs. And that goes back to, you know, Abraham and Joshua and all the others, Jacob, and different ones.
Well, how do you feel, Karen, about this Gospel of Judas, if indeed the capture, the arrest of Jesus was, created in order for all these events to occur?
Well,
does it bother you?
No. When I first heard that about Judas, I knew the Christ was in control, Jesus was, and he picked his people specifically for what they were going to do at the time of his ministering and after. And I knew someone had to do the dirty work. And in my heart of hearts, anyone who would be near him would understand him and would have to obey, even if it ripped his soul out, that he would have to be the one for the prophecies and all the Jewish messianic scriptures to come true. Someone had to do the job, and it had to be done in a certain order. And there was 30 pieces of silver that had to fall prophetically, had to fall into someone's hands.
Do you back that up, William?
Well, let me, as she was talking about the Great Pyramid connection, let me just mention something that I think about when I'm at the Giza Plateau. If you look at a top-down view of the Giza Plateau as provided by a satellite image, for instance,
yes, you
don't see three pyramids, you see three crosses, exactly the configuration
That's a good point. You see at the crucifixion.
Yeah. We see an empty tomb. We see the Great Pyramid as an empty tomb. And strangely, the Egyptian term for the Giza Plateau was Rosto. The Greek word for the pillar of crucifixion, not cross, but pillar was the original word, the Greek word is Stavro. Rosto and Stavro are mirror images of one another. And it makes me wonder if the actual site of crucifixion was in fact the Giza Plateau, and the empty tomb that Mary Magdalene went to on Easter morning was in fact the Great Pyramid.
Good point. Let's go to our final caller, first-time caller. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, sir. Thank you.
Well, I know I'm going to probably get laughed at for this one, but...
you're already laughing. I haven't even heard you yet.
I've always been curious and kind of what I've always thought was a lighthearted conspiracy theory behind the TV shows Stargate, that the TV shows are on TV to desensitize the public to the existence of such technology. And I was just curious what your guests might think of that.
I think we see example after example of that, don't we? Look at Star Trek and how the creations in Star Trek, the flip phone, the communicator, have been translated into our common technology vis-a-vis the cell phone. There's almost, just so many examples of that. And I think that we're going to start to see the same thing in the movie Stargate. But what is required here, I believe, is not just an apprehension of the possibility of this technology, but what we have to begin to get a hold of is the metaphysics behind this technology, the spiritual component of it. And this, I don't watch Stargate. I watched the movie. I watched the movie Contact. Those are my favorite.
I love that movie.
Yeah. But I don't watch Stargate SG-1. I don't watch Stargate Atlantis. I don't want to be corrupted, in a sense, because I have a vision. I follow my own vision. If it matches what is in the collective imagination, that's outstanding. But I do feel that the gentleman caller has a very valid point, that be it a secretive organization that filters us through, or if it's just the collective imagination of humankind, which is the greatest nation all of us can be a part of, says my friend Brian Gore, the imagination, it's being reflected all around us. It's instructing us. It's pointing to the potential that we all have. And when someone's doing that, I'm all for it.
Well, I got to tell you, you have been once again doing yeoman's work for all of us, William. Thank you so much. Your website, williamhenry.net. And are you going to be in the National Geographic show once they put it together?
Yes. They shot 5-6 hours of video of me, so I presume they're going to whittle it down to about 2 minutes, and I'll keep you posted as I get word.
Yeah, let me know. We'll let everybody know when you're going to be on. That'll be fun to watch.
And by the way, I'll be in L.A. in July, too, for the L.A. MUFON meeting and the Orange County meeting, so hopefully we'll be able to get together with you.
Part of July, I should be in L.A., so make sure you track me down.
Okay. Blessings to you, George.
Okay. William Henry. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Nikki Imbrunoni, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition, where it'll be our Friday into Saturday night open lines, and I shall be giving you 4 hours of open lines this time. Until then, be safe, everyone.